You're listening to a rebroadcast of All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. This is day two of the All of It Guide to Your Holiday Week. All week long, we're bringing you suggestions for arts and culture activities to explore in the city. Yesterday, we talked books. Today, we're talking art. Andy Warhol is perhaps the most ubiquitous artist of the 20th century. Campbell soup cans, sculptures made of Brillo boxes, and even the Rolling Stones tongue logo. All iconic images associated with Warhol decades after his death. He made art that even non-patrons of the art world encountered on a regular basis. And yet, hard as it is to believe, Andy Warhol has not had a full career retrospective in the U.S. in more than three decades. But that all changed this fall with the opening of Andy Warhol From A to B and Back Again, a monumental exhibit that opened at the Whitney Museum of American Art. It runs through March 31st before moving on to Chicago and San Francisco, and it's a terrific indoor cozy winter activity to check out this week. The exhibit was curated by the Whitney's Donna DeSalvo, who joined us in studio to talk about it. And we're rebroadcasting that conversation now.
What were your goals in curating this?
Well, you know, it was really an attempt to bring some clarity, I think, to an artist who's so profusive, made so much work, that in a way it's almost impossible in a certain way to grapple with it all. But also to sort of situate the work and its development over the course of Warhol's career and see his experiences as a commercial illustrator when he first comes to New York, as well as, you know, how Warhol is really grappling with the fundamental problems of art making. And that's often lost in so much of the discussion that has happened during Warhol's era when he was alive and even after he died, as just the man with the funny wig who went to a lot of parties. And he's so much more than that.
He was so prolific. In deciding what would be in this exhibit, how did you make your choices and how did you decide to organize it?
Sure. Well, you know, I think, first of all, I decided that the best thing was to do it largely chronologically because it's the way to track, in a sense, the development of Warhol's thinking, his ideas. And there are certain key works that you just can't imagine a Warhol retrospective without. The 32 Campbell soup cans from the Museum of Modern Art, or the Marilyn diptych, you know, from the Tate, or nine Jackies from the Whitney's own collection. So they're just sort of key works. And I had done a show years ago on the 50s called Success is a Job in New York at the Gray Art Gallery that was of the commercial work. So I knew a lot of that work. The hardest thing, of course, is there's so much really, really great work. And, you know, I had certain feelings about certain works that just do certain things. And so I had to be very judicious in making those decisions about either introducing a new idea, a new paradigm shift, or that show how Warhol engages with color and then re-engages with it. And also painting, hand painting. And a lot of that you see in the early days of the 60s, but then again in the 70s and 80s when Warhol's career had fallen off. And then throw on top of that film, photography, video, publishing, television. It's tough, but it's one of the challenges that you live for as a curator.
I'm sure. I want to talk about a couple of the pieces that I didn't know that well and I think are really interesting. Ladies and Gentlemen, from 1975. It's one of his few portraitures where we don't know the identities necessarily of the people, and that they're anonymous for a reason.
Yes.
Will you tell people about this?
Sure. So he was approached by a dealer in Italy to do a series of portraits of, the term would be used then, of drag queen or trans people. And he did not want the superstars of the factory, Candy Darling. He didn't want them. And so Warhol went on a search with his friend Bob Colicello to find sitters. And he went to a New York club called the Gilded Grape, where there are a lot of drag performers. And they were each asked to pose for, they didn't know they were posing for Warhol. They got paid a very little amount of money, like $50. And Warhol made Polaroids of them, which we then translated into photographs. Now, it's interesting because when he showed them, they were called Ladies and Gentlemen. And there are very few paintings where Warhol also features people of color. And so in our showing of them, and others have done even earlier than us, we've actually included the names because we know who they are. Mm-hmm. They signed the Polaroids. And one of them in particular is Marsha P. Johnson, who was a very leading figure in the gay rights movement, very involved with Stonewall, Wilhelmina Ross, who had a band. So it's interesting.
How much times have changed?
Luckily.
Yes. Yes.
Luckily. And I think we're sensitized to, you know, saying, well, they're not just anonymous individuals. You know, and it's part of the complexity of Warhol and the different circles in which he moved and those he didn't move within. Mm-hmm. They're also introduced color in an amazing way. And there's a great essay in the catalog by the artist Glenn Ligon, who really talks about that, who speaks from the perspective as an African-American man and artist of colored and color. Mm-hmm. And really, you see Warhol with these exuberant colors, and the poses are kind of amazing to see these individuals who were performers and full of life in these portraits. So it's an incredible series, and there are hundreds of them. We only have a small selection, but we have a one that's really large scale that's fantastic.
There's also his first ever public artwork.
The Most Wanted Men.
Yes, The Most Wanted Men. When was it created and what for?
Well, he made it for the New York State Pavilion of the World's Fair. So Philip Johnson, the architect, designed the pavilion, and he commissioned a number of artists, many of the pop artists, Roy Lichtenstein, Klaus Oldenburg, along with Ellsworth Kelly, to make works for the facade of the pavilion. And Warhol was decided that he would use these images taken from a New York City police bulletin of individuals wanted for crimes. And he silkscreened them onto a huge canvas, and they were put on the facade of the pavilion. Now, fair organizers weren't so happy about this. They thought that they were perhaps not the image they should project into the fair and family friendly. They asked him to submit something else. He wanted to have a portrait of Robert Moses, the great either destroyer or maker of New York. Obviously, he's a contentious figure. And they said no. So he painted them over in silver. And that was it. He also made a film series called The 13 Most Beautiful Boys. So this is where you see these dual mm-hmm. aspects of Warhol. And I still think it's an incredibly outrageous thing to have put at the World's Fair at that period of time. This is pre-Stonewall. It's a very different time. But not everybody got that reading of it.
Mm-hmm.
People knew who were in the know. Anyway, that's why, and they're the anti-hero. They're the complete opposite of what, you know, you would have expected. But it's why it's such an incredible series.
We're speaking with Donna DeSalvo. She curated the Andy Warhol Show from A to B and Back Again, which is currently at the Whitney. It just opened up. There is the Death and Disaster series as well, which really you get a sense of how obsessed he was with media and headlines. Mm-hmm. In terms of this series, how does it fit into his whole career?
Sure. Well, it's a very important series, and it's often seen as one of his pivotal series of works. I mean, he was obsessed with media because we're obsessed with media. So he was reflecting in a sense the cultural desire for news. Mm. And, you know, spectacle and tragedy, sadly, sells. So he picked up on that. So many of the images were discarded from AP Wire Photo or UPI because they were too gruesome. Some of them actually appeared in magazines. So he was going to do a show in Paris, which he was going to call Death in America. And these were that's where they were first shown. So you have images of car crashes, suicides, and you have some where they're really speaking to historical moments. So the Mustard Race Riot, which uses the famous Charles Moore photograph of the civil rights protest in Birmingham, where the protesters are attacked by dogs. Or there's one of two women who die as a result of eating tainted tuna fish. They die botulism, you know. Or you also have a suicide of a woman who's fallen from jumped from the Empire State Building. Some of these appeared in Life magazine. Some of them never made it because they were so gruesome. But I think what you see there is you move from celebrity to this anonymous, because these are we don't know who these mm-hmm. people are. And it also gives you the darker side of Warhol's whole project. You know, there's a dark side to Warhol. There's a dark side to consumption, to overconsumption. And also, look, there's a base instinct that attracts us to looking at some of these images. You know, we're bombarded with them. And, you know, Warhol grows up in the age of radio. TV comes into the picture like mid-50s. Mm-hmm. So we're more and more, that culture, that time, people are looking at images far more. And the great pictorial magazines, Life, Look, as well as New York Post, Daily Mirror. Some of these things don't even exist anymore. So the picture became the language, and we're in it even more today.
I think about that sometimes as I was walking through. I thought, what about if Andy Warhol were alive during the internet?
Yes.
It sort of makes your head spin.
Yeah, he's
a
pre-digital guy.
Yeah, it's an amazing thought. There's also some very interesting behind the scenes, almost like quotidian pictures of him vacuuming a gallery where he's going to have a show. Why was it important to have that be part of the show?
Well, that's actually a work of art. So he, well, because I think that when Warhol was shot in 1968 by Valerie Solanas, who had written a book called Scum, The Society for Cutting Up Men, and she was very unhappy with Warhol. He promised to produce one of her screens into a movie. It didn't happen, and she shot him, and he was it was a near fatal shooting. He comes, has a period of convalescence. You know, oftentimes people think this is when Warhol's work declines. And what you see through some of these experiments in this period of 68 to 72 are actually how fertile his mind is. And I believe you learn a lot from an artist by seeing the works that actually never make the quote unquote big time, because they show the process. You know, it's never A to Z.
Right.
It's A to B, A to Z, A to D, back and forth. And so that gallery, that's actually a project he was asked to do for a women's college that doesn't exist anymore called Finch College.
Right? Yeah.
And he, along with a number of other artists, were invited to do projects in the gallery. So what does he do? Something so simple, as you say, so quotidian. He vacuums the gallery, it's documented, and he leaves behind the bag of dirt. So all that exists. And I just think it shows him as a conceptual artist, shows him as humor, shows him as also looking at almost kind of emptiness and nothingness, which is, you know, a serious read, serious and funny simultaneously.
There's also one of these time capsules.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he do those?
So they start from a very pragmatic place. They were moving factories, moving the studio. He had all this junk that people sent him, you know, fan letters, invitations, all kinds of things. So it started very practically. Vincent Fremont, who worked with him for many years, they just got these boxes and he started packing things away. At a certain point, he just systematizes it. So there's 660 of these time capsules. And they just have an array of things. And I think they're so great because they might be the kind of thing you might find in an archaeological dig someday. And we have one on display from the period around 1972, 73. And they're fan letters, Christmas cards, things from Yves Saint Laurent, artists like Ray Johnson. It runs the gamut from the famous to the unknown. Some of them are their books. Apparently they opened a time capsule at the Andy Warhol Museum that had a birthday cake that wasn't eaten. So you get the sense of the stream and the flow of culture. And in a way, that's the source for so much of what Warhol brings into all aspects of his art.
We're speaking with Donna DeSalvo. She curated Andy Warhol from A to B and back again, which is currently at the Whitney. Where do we see his background? He's Andy Warhol. He grew up Catholic. Where do we see this in the show?
Sure. Well, there's an early room in the exhibition where actually there are only a few pieces from his time when he was a student at the Carnegie Institute of Technology, now Carnegie Mellon. And one of them is from a class assignment for social observation. And he elects to make a painting of his family's living room. And you see this very lived-in home. It's a crucifix on the mantelpiece. Mm-hmm. The furniture is, you know, kind of slightly looks hand-me-down, full of character. But I think what you see there is the evidence of Warhol before Warhol. He's a kid from a working class immigrant background. His parents are from Czechoslovakia. His father was a coal miner. He's the first in his family to graduate college. He uses the name Warhola, and which is the family name. He eventually drops off the A to become Warhol. And I think, you know, and he's a gay kid growing up in Pittsburgh. So I think it sets the stage for how Warhol is both an insider and an outsider. He has a great desire to be famous. He loves writing away to movie stars, to getting their pictures. As I said, he's a child of radio. So there's an imagination. That's why I love radio, because it really keeps the imagination really sharp. And he, you know, has this aspiration. And it's the story of many people who come to New York to make their fortune. So I think that's the human side of Warhol. And it's very difficult, I think, for someone who created a brilliant persona, his invention, wore the funny wigs, all the things that make it very difficult to actually see Warhol as an artist who, you know, had to make a living. I mean, he wasn't going to he knew this romantic idea that, you know, artists could just make art and not worry about making a living. It was just a fantasy. So he's a hard worker, and as is all of his family. Yeah. Years ago, I traveled to Pittsburgh, and I met his brothers, and his nephew, Jamie Warhola, participated through loans to the show. And it's very interesting, of course, to see very different sides, you know, for many people who move from their, leave their family and move to another city. And there's a relationship, but not. You're living a completely different life in certain ways. And that's when you go to Pittsburgh. I think you also, as you said, you had gone to Pittsburgh. You see that because it's one of the great American cities. So I think it comes out, and it's evident in that gallery of the 50s. You don't really see it again in quite the same way. And that's why it was so important to, for a variety of reasons, but that's one of the reasons I included those works in the exhibition.
There's a great kids book called Uncle Andy's
Cats.
That's by
Jamie Warhola, his nephew.
Yes. I read it to my son all the time. It's one of my favorite books because it really does give you an insight to Andy Warhol in a different way.
It's a kid's perspective because he was growing up around Uncle Andy.
It's a great book, by the way, for folks, if you've got a kid out there. I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's so much different kind of medium in this. We've got silk screens, you've got video, you've got film, you've got painting. Was it, when you think about his career, is there one form of medium you think is quintessential Warhol?
I guess it would have to be the paintings, because it is, for all the greatness, and the film, I have to say, it's painting and film. It's hard to say, because his films are very revolutionary and very important. You know, that's a body of work that roughly is from 63 to the late 60s. And his paintings, because that's really, they're radical in rethinking what a painting could be. And, you know, one of the great joys, I have a young team of colleagues I've worked with, Mark Luacano, Christy Mitchell, and Lauren Young, and they're a very different generation. And I have to say, it's been really fascinating to get their insight, you know, about Warhol and what they connect to. And some of it was in the film, some of it's his TV programs that he did. And then, of course, the paintings. So the different types of media really work in different ways. And they're also coming from a digital background. So they have a very interesting connection. They see the painting through, in some ways, the history of art, but also the lens of the digital.
That's so interesting. You figure you've got people who are in their early 30s who don't know anything about that, him as a living artist.
Yes. Well, you know, the last Warhol retrospective was in 1989.
At MoMA, right?
Yeah. Yes. So I'm really very gratified with this exhibition, and I hope it actually now informs a new generation.
I would say plan a good 2 or 3 hours if you're going to go.
It's a big show.
The show is called Andy Warhol From A to B and Back Again. It is at the Whitney now through March 2019. Thank you so much, Donna DeSalvo. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today's show is dedicated to some of our favorite art exhibitions. We're bringing you rebroadcasts of our conversations we had about various art shows throughout the city. Our next recommendation is a show called Soul of a Nation at the Brooklyn Museum. Soul of a Nation showcases some of the work that played a pivotal role in one of the most significant political movements of the 20th century. And you're hearing Charles Mingus's Better Get Hit in Your Soul. It's one of the pieces of music you'll encounter as you make your way through the exhibit. Ashley James is the assistant curator of contemporary art at the Brooklyn Museum, and Ann Pasternak is the museum's director. They joined us in October to discuss Soul of a Nation, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation now.
Ann, this started out originally at the Tate Modern.
Yes.
In London. How did it wind up in Brooklyn, and what had to shift and change a little bit to bring it to Brooklyn?
Well, I got a call at 8 in the morning on a Sunday from Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation. And when Darren calls, you pick it up. So he said, Ann, there's this incredible exhibition that's going to happen at the Tate Modern. I think it's perfect for the Brooklyn Museum. Can I connect you guys? And I said, absolutely. And within a week, we had signed on to being the first venue in the United States to take Soul of a Nation. And I have to say, the Tate was an awesome partner.
When you bring a show over like that, do you take it completely as is intact, or do you end up having to change it some?
I think the best shows you always have to change. So while it's an excellent question, so while we do take traveling exhibitions, we try to make it our own and speak to our audiences. The truth is the Brooklyn Museum has done a number of historic exhibitions on Black power and civil rights. So this was an extension of work we'd already done, and we wanted to advance the story a bit more for our audiences.
So Ashley, during this whole exhibit, there's this conversation that's happening among Black artists at that time. What were some of the elements of that conversation? I know it's set up, we'll talk about the geography of it in a second, but sort of the overarching themes, some things in that conversation.
Yeah, some overarching themes include collective art-making practices versus individual practices, abstraction versus figuration, kind of what mediums Black artists are able to access and receive attention for, the question of the institution and whether or not mainstream institutions actually give space for Black artists is a major theme, amongst others.
So I mentioned that the show is divided by geography. Can you tell from where the artists are from and where they're living and they're working, the influences it has on their work? I mean, there wasn't like a monolith experience across, it's like, this is what Black activists are like.
Yes, I think geography provides a kind of access point for understanding the period. It's in no way conclusive, but I do think that you see, you know, in New York is kind of where the more mainstream traditional art practices take place and institutions, mainstream institutions take root, versus in a place like Chicago, which you see is a space of community, is where artists come together in a kind of familial setting and kind of work in a less formalized way. That's one difference. LA is a third in which being outside of the mainstream New York really gave them an opportunity to access a more radical practice. So you see assemblage and you see the beginnings of performance there, etc.
And I think one of the overarching things is that artists were asking, is there a Black aesthetic? Should there be a Black aesthetic? What might that be? And so you see this as a debate really running throughout the course of the exhibition.
Yes.
Right. There's no answer.
No. And that's still a resonant question today.
We start in New York. It starts in New York. And since we're in New York, we'll start there, too. Tell me about the Spiral Group. Who was in the Spiral Group? What was their cohesive message?
Yeah, so the Spiral Group consisted of 15 painters, including Romare Bearden, Norman Lewis, Emma Amos, Merton Simpson, and a number of others, who came together really in 1963 to organize a bus to the March on Washington. So this political impetus has always kind of been there and is a question percolating in the show. And in the aftermath, they decided that they wanted to come together and just think about what it would mean to make a Black art, as Anne was speaking to, and also a related but different political art. So they met kind of casually to think through the question of how, as a Black artist, can I respond to this movement?
There was one woman, correct, in the Spiral Group?
Yes.
Well, tell me about her.
Emma Amos, also the youngest member of Spiral. She was actually a student of a member of Spiral and kind of was brought in via pedagogical practice. And, you know, the fact that she was the sole member is kind of indicative of the still gender imbalance of the period. Even within Black liberation spaces, you still see that that is the case.
One of the most striking pieces is America the Beautiful. And can you describe it for our audience?
Which one is that? Is that the Norman Lewis?
Yes.
Yes.
So that's my favorite piece, and I didn't even know the title. There you have it. One of the things the artists had agreed to, maybe the only thing that they had agreed to in these conversations, was creating black and white work at the time. So this is a piece, a good-sized canvas that's black and white, mostly black, and it looks like there are these white expressive marks on it. But as you get closer, you realize it's a Klan rally at night. It's an incredibly powerful, haunting painting that really gets you to your very, very core. And when I first saw Soul of a Nation and I saw that painting, I said, if there was nothing else great in this exhibition, it was worth it just to see this work, which is in a private collection.
It's stark.
It is.
It's really stark.
Right.
And it gets you. If there's something about it that catches you right in the solar plexus, I don't know what it is.
Absolutely.
Ashley, was there a significance that the pieces of work had to be black and white?
Yes. So in 1965, Spiral launched one exhibition in which the kind of cohesive theme of that show was black and white, which allowed them to access kind of political and social resonances, political and aesthetic resonances, while still kind of allowing for the elasticity of an individual practice.
There is a note about the Brooklyn Museum Community Garden around this time.
Community Gallery.
Gallery, excuse me.
Yep.
Tell us, our listeners, about that.
Well, in the 1960s, there were protests at the museum, even back then. And, you know, people wanted to see greater representation, rightly so. The truth is that our institutions in general have had historic blinders to being truly inclusive spaces for artists. And so we hired a curator who created the Community Art Gallery, and a lot of amazing artists had shows at that time in the Community Gallery. And it lasted, I'm not quite sure how long, about...
roughly 2 decades.
Yeah, so a long time. And we've been doing research about this period of our history and thinking about what can we learn from the past and carry through to the present moment. So stay tuned.
Okay. We're speaking with Ann Pasternak, director of the Brooklyn Museum, and Ashley James, the curator of the Soul of the Nation exhibit. It's up through February 3rd, so you have plenty of time to go see it. Let's talk about some of the other regions. There is part of the exhibit that's about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. What were their roles?
Yes.
This time.
So that is an addition to the Brooklyn presentation here, thinking about the role of the South within this larger story. And it's a complicated question because there isn't as much of a sense of a kind of collective movement of painters there that you see in New York, for instance. But you do find that there are institutions that serve as the kind of what I call the incubators for many of the artists, politicians, et cetera, who come out of this moment and, you know, really contribute to the movement in various ways. David Driscoll, who is a artist and professor, grounds that section.
I think it's interesting that you did include the South because it's such an important part of the story, between whether it's the Great Migration or whether it's slavery. And it was interesting to me to think about the generational differences also at this time, because that's what the 60s were about as well, the generational differences. Do we have the Black Power movement, or do we work within the system? Do we see that anywhere in the exhibit, that push or pull, or is this mostly just about the young folks who want to get out there and break the system?
That's a really good question. And I think that you still see that there's an older generation involved. I mean, I think maybe an example of that is Romare Bearden is shown it in Spiral, but then later on, he found Cinque Gallery in 1968. So he's still kind of involved in the movement. Someone like Betty Saar cites Martin Luther King's assassination as a real turning point for her career, mm-hmm. Even though she's a bit older than some of the other artists in the show. So I do think that intergenerationally, you do see a kind of heightened awareness, a heightened urgency around contributing to the movement.
And you know what's interesting too is that we are now starting, not we as the Brooklyn Museum, but as a larger art field, are paying more and more serious attention to these artists from this time period. So it's great to focus on these roughly 2 decades of work, but they've continued to make really powerful work throughout their careers. And it's time also for institutions to stand up and show what they've been doing throughout their entire lives. So they've been very influential to a younger generation of artists, but often they know about their work through publication rather than through seeing it actually in our institutions.
So what do you think that large institutions need to do to make that happen?
You know, people often say to me, Anne, I don't believe in women's shows, or I don't believe in shows about a particular, you know, demographic. And my point is that until there's real equity, we need to spotlight the excellent, extraordinary practices that were happening, and also integrate them into the collections and the exhibitions that we do, and spotlight the individual artists. So, you know, it's a multivalent commitment that the Brooklyn Museum has historically had, and we're just continuing to grow.
Let's talk about the West Coast artists. They were working in some different mediums than the East Coast artists. Can you tell folks about some of the work?
Yes. Yeah, so this exhibition really focuses on one type of sculpture called assemblage, which really was about taking materials that already existed in the world and recombining them to forge something new, and really call into question this idea that fine art is separate from one's life and is something that you can't access in your daily life, that it's really a part of one's quotidian practice.
You know what's also interesting about that? Because a lot of that work seems very influenced by the kind of aesthetics of the South. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of artists like Robert Rauschenberg and others who seem, they must have been very clearly influenced by, you know, these artists from the South, and yet that's not something that's normally discussed in their practice.
Definitely. And that section draws heavily from the work of Dr. Kelly Jones, who makes that argument that this idea of migration and what was brought from the South is really heavily influential for LA in particular.
There's just one piece that's very striking, The Liberation of Aunt Jemima.
Yes.
Can you describe it for me?
We bought that piece. I'm so proud.
Oh, you did?
We had the Molotov cocktail.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. That one's good too. No, that's not one of the seven
that's
words.
So
don't worry.
True.
Yes. Well, there's a rebellious spirit of this work, which features this racist caricature, Aunt Jemima. In a small plexi box that Miss Saar has sourced from a flea market. And she literally arms her with a rifle, a Black Power fist emblazoned on her surface. And really the work is iconographic of the period because it's really foregrounding this idea of taking this servile figure and pulling her straight into a Black liberatory future.
Especially a female figure.
Yes.
Which is why I got so excited, because it's one of the great works, and I wish we owned it. But well, our Molotov cocktail is in there, the show, too.
So which one? Tell us about that one, the one that you bought.
Go ahead, Ashley. If you want facts, just talk to Ashley.
It's a Molotov cocktail made from one of these racist caricature bottle. And I'm not even sure exactly how to describe it. It's an assemblage piece. I can't recall the exact commercial product that it is. But again, taking this image.
There were all those like little Black Sambo things.
Exactly.
Whenever I'm in the South and I'm in an antique store and I see those, I put them on their heads. It's my own little private protest in like antique stores.
Well, you know, it's still controversial today to take these stereotypical images and share them with the world in a way that upends them. Mm-hmm. And it was a very powerful and radical thing for Betty Saar to do, and it still continues to be.
Let's look at the Bay Area, obviously the birthplace of the Black Panthers. Yeah. Emory Douglas is very prominently figured.
Yes. He and Cleveland Bellow are the two figures in that section, and Emory Douglas was, of course, the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. 1966 is when it forms in Oakland, and that section is really foregrounding who is an artist who is a revolutionary artist in the most essential sense of the term. I don't know if there's a more political artist in the show, but you see that he has such a specific graphic sensibility that you understand through seeing his works kind of collectively, and this the bold outlining, the radial lines, the oversized rifle, all of these kinds of indicators of revolution.
Ann Pasternak, director of the Brooklyn Museum, and Ashley James, curator of the Soul of a Nation exhibit. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you so much.
The exhibit is on until February 3rd. We're going to leave you a little another piece of music from the exhibit, Miles Davis's It Never Entered My Mind.